Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. The countdown to the end of the year is on, and we thought what would be a great idea for a closing show of the decade would be to take sort of a decade in review and see what's been happening around the world. It's a bit of a quiet fintech week this week. There's not a lot of news on. There's funding announcements are slowing down. People's travel is slowing down. There's not a lot happening. I just went to a couple of my favorite news sites like TechCrunch and Finextra and so forth, and there's not a lot happening. So I think instead of talking about what's happening this week, let's talk about what has happened this decade. To join me on the show is a regular and co-hosting today, John Best from Big Consulting. John, welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
How are you leading up towards your Christmas New Year's break?
It's been really fantastic. I'm about to take my, speaking of technologies in this decade, I'm about to take my FAA Part 107 test, which is the unmanned drone section of the Federal Aviation Group. So
very
it's
cool.
Been a little bit of studying for that, but other than that, just having fun and enjoying Christmas.
Yeah, so I know it's quite interesting now because a lot of the software you have for operating drones, when you started with drones, and we obviously will get into talking about drones, but when you started, you could sort of do anything you want, but these days, you've got no fly zones and all of that, and it's all built into the smartphone software, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, joining us from Singularity University is someone that has been on the show a couple of times before. His name is Will Weissman. Will is the Executive Director at Singularity University and Managing Director at Kitty Hawk Ventures, which is a frontier tech early stage venture capital fund. And Will, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Brad. Thank you, John. Great to be with you guys.
And where are you based at the moment, Will?
So I am full-time down in Santa Monica, but I'm actually talking to you from beautiful Baja, California. So down in Mexico on a little bit of a kiteboarding adventure for a couple weeks to finish up my year.
Thought you'd get out of town while the impeachment hearings are on, smart man.
Exactly.
All right. Okay, so the topic of our show today is the decade in review. Now, we're going to start with a macro view of the big changes that have happened this decade, and then we'll try and drill down at the end of the show at what's been happening in fintech. What are some of the biggest innovations in fintech over that time? And of course, one of the things that is sort of interesting to look back on is what were the technologies we thought were going to be huge? And in that respect, I think it's going to be very interesting to hear from Will. Singularity University, of course, was founded by two sort of legendary futurists in the space, Ray Kurzweil, who was one of the founders, also obviously a thought leader at Google these days on the strategy side, and Peter Diamandis, who's been on the show a couple of times, and both of them were founders of the Singularity University concept, but also both are very future-looking characters. So, Will, what's it like to work with, because you get to work with Peter quite regularly, Ray probably not as regularly, but what's it like working with those guys?
It's a pretty mind-expanding place to be out there. Actually, Peter and I just did a webcast last week.
Yeah, I saw that.
About an hour with him. And, he's an extraordinary thinker. They're both extraordinary thinkers. And so the chance to be around individuals that are pushing the envelope and on, what the world, and how we think about the world that we're living in, and obviously are able to create all sorts of incredibly insightful thoughts and viewpoints in terms of where we're going is incredibly invigorating and dynamic. I mean, it's a great platform to get to connect with extraordinary human beings and get a little taste of maybe a little bit more than a little taste of where the world is going and get to hopefully help me move forward also in a positive way.
Absolutely. And of course, Peter was instrumental in one of my favorite initiatives of actually it was, I don't know if this fits into the decade because when was Spaceship One? That was 2004, wasn't it, or something like that?
Yeah, I think that was the prior decade, yep.
Right, okay.
Yep. So, but amazing what they've got at XPRIZE.
Right, so Peter was sort of the creator of the XPRIZE or created the momentum behind it, at least, and of course that led to the first private spaceship into low Earth orbit, Spaceship One, on October the 4th. That was... first flight was on May 20th, 2003, built by Scale Composite. So that's one of Peter's achievements back in the previous decade. But what do you guys think? What do you guys think was sort of the top? Let's start with what do you think is the most important technology of the decade?
I mean, I would say it's artificial intelligence. I think we've seen AI, really come into its own over this last decade and starting to touch just about, every industry and like a lot of these exponentially growing technologies, right? In the early days, very, very deceptive. And, as you talk about, Brett, in some of your writings as well, I mean, in the earliest days, right, we were amazed when AI was able to go and compete against checkers and beat a human, and then it was chess, and now it's Go, and actually now beating, RPG players, and I think, if there's any technology that is profoundly changing how we do business, how companies operate, how governments operate, and how everyday consumers operate, I would have to say that artificial intelligence is probably at the top of my list.
Did you see Lisa Dole's comments a couple of weeks ago where he said it's no use him even trying to compete anymore with...
It's a little sad, right? It's a little sad.
Yeah.
I think it's going to change, right? It's obviously changing a lot of jobs. There's a lot of talk about jobs disappearing as a result of AI, but I think we're also going to see AI really start to become a powerful tool that people are going to use as part of their jobs, and their jobs will just evolve. I don't know how the job of being a Go grandmaster evolves too much, but so he may be in danger, but I think we're going to continue to see, profound impacts in the decades ahead from AI.
Well, we'll always need robot repair people and robot psychologists, I guess.
Yeah, I've been worrying about those Roombas that have all those cats riding around on them.
Yes.
At some point, they're going to rebel against that. That's just demoralizing.
Yeah, that's right.
The Roombas will rise up. That's what I predict.
The Roombas will rise up. No more cats. Yes. So, John, what do you think? What apart from artificial intelligence, what are some of the big technologies that have had impact this decade?
This technology was created a little bit before that, but it's really come into its own, and that's distributive ledger technology. And I don't mean from a cryptocurrency standpoint. I mean the magic of being able to do basically business that's no longer centralized. So having a decentralized platform and all of the business impact that's going to have and continue to have as we go forward is extremely powerful. And coupled with AI and some of the data, pieces, it's going to be a big play.
Yeah. And do you see DLT or distributed ledger technology and blockchain being an example of that? Do you see that as an evolution of the database or do you see that as something else?
I see it as something else. I see it as a new way to deal with trust and contracts in the business model that didn't exist before. And because of that, it opens the door to a whole lot of other things. The database is really, to me, a natural byproduct of it.
But aren't you describing the utility on top of a distributed database? Because that's essentially what makes blockchain or DLT different from conventional databases, which are stored in one location, right? Whether it's in the cloud or on a on-premise computer.
No, I'm actually talking about the consensus mechanism. While it is stored in a database, the actual consensus mechanisms and how far we've come from Byzantine fault tolerance to asynchronous Byzantine fault tolerance, which is the way that people come to a consensus. Think of it like this. If we were to say, hey, you know, Brett, we're going to take a vote. And a good example, you know, we talk about the current process that's going to the Senate. And one of the concerns we have here is that people will vote in a way that will protect their jobs. But what if people could vote in a way that would be anonymous but still 100% trackable? And so if we were going to take a vote, we might take a bunch of piece of paper and toss it into a hat. Well, then which of the three of us gets to count the hat? Who do we trust? But if we could magically recreate the hat and for sure know that no one could mess with the data that's in the hat, now we have something special. So to me, mm-hmm. it's a little more than that.
So I tell you what I'm going to pick as my top technology of the decade, and we'll, I don't think this would be any surprise to you, probably not to you either, John, but I'm going to say SpaceX's reusable rocket.
I am not surprised.
I agree.
It's just such a huge change to the way we think about space travel. It changed the economics of the business. You know, some of the achievements of SpaceX, the first private company to successfully launch, orbit, and recover a spacecraft, the Dragon capsule, on a demo flight December 9, 2010. The first private company to send a spacecraft to the International Space Station, 2012. The first private company to send a satellite into geosynchronous orbit, 2013. The first landing of an orbital rocket's first stage on land, 2015. I mean, you know, the first, it's just crazy what progress SpaceX as a private corporation in this field has made in a single decade. Now, fair enough, the Falcon 1 actually was the first liquid-fueled rocket to reach orbit, and that was 2008. But the really interesting stuff has happened this decade. I'm just blown away with the progress they've made.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's astounding what Elon has been able to do with SpaceX and how it's completely changed the economics around space and really enabled a whole new class of satellites with the micro and nano satellites and a whole new, you know, all sorts of new kind of real-time data imaging and data sources and communication technologies. And I think we're already starting to hear about it now. Like they're starting to become a real issue of just having too many satellites up in space.
Right, the Starlink issue.
You know, I think his last. Yeah, exactly. And there's incredible things that are going to come out of this. All sorts of incredible new businesses that are going to be founded as a result of it. And I think it's going to have a truly global and profound impact in the decade ahead.
Absolutely. One of the others that obviously it was a really phenomenal piece of technology is CRISPR and the technology around gene editing or gene therapy originally. The CRISPR-Cas9 research really sort of came into its own, but the CRISPR-Cas9 system was first described in a 2015 paper. And so it's, you know, we talk so much about gene editing these days and the potential impact of that. The first study in terms of the potential for CRISPR was in 2010, and the first actual application of gene therapy was in 2015. So this is a huge foundational technology for healthcare and the way we think about disease treatment and so forth over the coming decade, certainly.
You know, can I have a backup one to mine? Can I have a runner-up? Because sure. It kind of fits with yours, which is, you know, Amazon Web Services, and we're pointing out Amazon, but there's Azure, there's the cloud services. But these cloud services have been, I think, a big part of the underlying success of all of the things we just mentioned.
Yeah.
Because, you know, before, if you wanted to do any of these things, to map the human genome, for instance, which led to the CRISPR, you'd have to have a giant data center somewhere with an incredible large, you know, carbon footprint. And it was just out of the reach of the average person. And now, you know, we've got where you could, you know, I could fire up four servers to do something before we end this show.
Yeah.
You know, right on Amazon. And I don't know, Will, from your perspective, but I would see that as a big enabler and a very, well, not a, a super technology breakthrough, but a sort of super technology business breakthrough.
I would just add on top of that, it's another example of technology driving the democratization of something, right?
Yes.
Driving down costs. And we've seen that over and over and over again, where technology takes something that is a relatively scarce and expensive resource and makes it readily available to the masses. And that enables all sorts of extraordinary new development and growth and businesses to launch from that. And AWS is an amazing example of a technology and a product, a service, really, right? It's touched probably millions of companies now across the globe.
Absolutely. Another one that I like that sort of fits in with sort of the SpaceX theme is the other stuff that Elon Musk has been involved in, of course, the self-driving car, with the autopilot built into that. Of course, we have Google deeply involved in that as well with Waymo and so forth. But we also have, related to this, Tesla's developed some incredible battery technology, and that now is being deployed as part of the grid in various parts. Obviously, the Tesla Powerwall is popular in places like California, but we've seen industrial scale Powerwall implementations or Tesla battery implementations in places like Adelaide in South Australia, where the grid during peak hours was unstable, and rather than injecting natural gas turbines into that system, Tesla was able to provide a significant energy storage capability there using battery tech.
Yeah, Brett, I would even broaden your comments to say that I think this last decade was also very much a decade about renewables in general. And I think the world is in the midst of doing this really dramatic transition away from fossil fuel-based energy sources to renewables. And we saw, solar energy and wind and an unsubsidized basis now starting to best traditional fossil fuel spot prices. And we're seeing that, more and more frequently. We know technology is just going to drive that cost down even further. And so the battery component is obviously going to be such an important piece to kind of creating this distributed new energy solution and being able to utilize renewables that we know have some kind of day cycle challenges along with them. But that to me, I think we're going to see this come to fruition in the decade ahead, but this decade that we're closing out really is for, in my mind, and I think is also one of the most exciting developments, because I think it's going to speak to some of the profound changes that we have to make in order to address climate change. These renewable technologies really, really getting to the point now where they not only are good things to do, but economically they make much more sense than the traditional energy sources.
Absolutely.
Right. And we're gonna need more power, because this next technology is what's gonna make the SpaceX stuff and Elon's plan to get to Mars doable, which is 3D printing. I actually saw yesterday where they're 3D printing a whole town somewhere in Mexico.
Well, I don't know whether you guys saw Dubai just launched the largest building ever printed, and in 2 weeks, it's just insane how incredible this is. So,
and that and one is that's a big game changer.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've got a portfolio company at SU called Made in Space that's actually doing 3D printing up on the International Space Station as we're talking, and just won a contract with the European Space Agency to design an inexpensive robotics arm that could be, completely assembled in space. So you start to think now about, sending up some of these basic raw materials and now having printers that allow you to create new, whether it's living spaces or a new complete satellites just from a single printer. It's pretty amazing. And not to mention, here terrestrially, we're seeing all sorts of, as you all mentioned, these homes being 3D printed now and office buildings being 3D printed, and not to mention all the incredible impact it's having on the manufacturing front for companies and altering the supply chain for them.
No, I saw where people, I'm sorry.
No, Brett, go ahead, John.
I saw where people were printing or two things. One, and this is another kind of, it's out there as a technology, but the impossible burger, basically. But interestingly enough, you can print both organs and human material and food.
Via printers, yep. Definitely in commercial medical use already. We've had 3D printed esophagus, 3D printed bladder, you know, fairly simple constructs from an organ perspective, but we're obviously working on, 3D printed hearts, 3D printed kidneys, things like that. It's pretty insane.
Well, and when you combine those, and you can, I don't know, have either of you had an Impossible Burger? Do you eat meat?
I have not had an Impossible Whopper yet, but I have had an Impossible Burger. And it does pretty well.
Beyond
Meat as well. I mean, both delicious, I think delicious burgers. And it's, you know, it's not exactly like a burger, but it's pretty, pretty tasty and pretty impressive. And I could say in its own right, you know, it was delicious. Like, I really enjoyed it. And I don't eat a ton of meat anymore. And so for me, it was, you know, it's a great, great solution.
But lab produced meat, not only plant-based meat substitutes such as Impossible and Beyond, but lab produced meat, of course, has made massive strides the last few years. That's again a new technology to appear this decade, and by the 2030s, that's going to revolutionize the way we think about farming and food production. Not only because it will dramatically reduce the carbon footprint of agriculture, but we're talking about a way to engineer meat at mass scales that is quite healthy for you.
You know,
I think it's going to be less about growing, you know, turning plants into meat, and it's going to be more about actually just growing protein in labs. And you're seeing it with fish as well. They're doing it with leather. So, and as you pointed out, I mean, you can, like with CRISPR, you can edit the genome, you can start to add in all sorts of different capabilities to give your protein, you know, specific tastes or specific visuals or textures if you're creating a leather, and to do it in a way that's so much more environmentally friendly and resource efficient. So I think this was the decade where we really started to see that stuff come into its own, and the 2020s is when we're going to see this start to actually have kind of mass and more wide scale impact, I think.
So can I take that agriculture piece? So I want to throw out there another thing that I've seen in the last decade that's really powerful. So turns out agriculture is one of the top adopters of technology, usually. I mean, they've always needed it. So one of my clients is Deer Credit Union out of Moline, and their major player is Deere. We were talking to their board.
Right, John Deere, manufacturing.
John Deere. Yeah. They showed me developer.deere.com. So what's happening, we're seeing, this is, and I'm not sure how to put it. I want to call it, like, it's not open source, but kind of open product, I guess. You know, we call it open banking in our side, but if you take it across everything. But their thought was, hey, we've got all these products. We want to create a cottage industry of people that are using our products, our soil samplers, those things, to make something on top of it. It's sort of the Apple App Store, which is kind of more 2010. So that was right around that time, which is a huge game changer. But this idea of commoditizing and building on top of these already, you know, tools that are in place that really bring together, I think, you know, a lot of power for people who want to do these sorts of things.
It's like they're creating a platform, right? For their own platform that they're
everybody's doing
machinery now. And yeah, that's so interesting.
Well, and that kind of leads to the drone discussion. So, you know, I saw recently where, so out here I have, you know, I coach kids for wrestling for a long time, and one of my kids is working in the forestry, and they're working with drones to plant trees. So it turns out these drone swarms can plant 1,000 more trees a minute than any humans ever could, you know, to put those back. And so it's interesting to me, sort of this idea of nano-controlled devices that are doing large-scale things. Like just recently we had a drone air show over. I live by the Air Force Academy. We had a drone air show, colored lights, one of the most spectacular things I've ever seen. You can Google it. Maybe we can throw it in the show.
No, it's this is happening all around the world. Dubai's got a massive one planned for the 2020 Expo drone show. It's replacing fireworks shows now.
Yeah. And they're much cooler because you can't get fireworks to make an entire eagle in the sky that's true. Animated and floating. But, you know, I look at all these things and these open source, and what I dig is it's kind of like all these ingredients are out there to the rest of the world. And now if Brett King wants to sit at his computer one night and grab some ingredients from Twitter and from Deere's, you know, developer thing and make something new, he can do that. And it just creates this never-ending opportunity for innovation, you know, out there, because there's so many permeations of the ways you can combine these ingredients.
What do you guys think in terms of what was a major piece of technology that either we didn't anticipate that came along? You know, you could put drones, I guess, in that category, you know, which, you know, Ramez Nam often likes to point out that we, you know, as science fiction really didn't talk a lot about drones before they appeared, they started to appear. So drones was one that sort of we didn't see coming. But then we had a lot of high hopes for the iPad, which launched in 2010, and it's been impactful, but you wouldn't say it's probably been as impactful as we thought it might be from a sci-fi perspective.
Well, I mean, for me... Oh, go ahead, Will.
No, go ahead, John, after you.
Well, for me, one of the technologies that has been surprising, and I think it's an end-of-the-decade technology that's going to have an incredibly dramatic impact, is Google's recent announcement of quantum supremacy. That has long been... And it's going to have good and bad impacts. I mean, it's a game changer at the scale that we've never seen before. So ending sort of this decade, which we still got one more year to go, you know, but having Google announce and legit, you know, a legit quantum supremacy and share the paper, that is one of those things that we've heard a lot, but I don't think anybody anticipated that in this decade anybody would hit supremacy. You know, I think everybody thought it was 3 or 4 years out. And Will, you probably know a lot about that, I would imagine.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to have, I think it is going to be this next decade. I mean, it's interesting because these things are always, a lot of times, like, it feels like change is happening so much faster than we were expecting. And then some of these things also seem like they're taking forever. I mean, we've been talking about longevity for forever, right? And some of these, whether it's stem cells or some of the work they're doing now with the genetics and writing the genome, it still feels like a lot of these things are taking too long to really get out into the market and to start to impact us. I do think in the 2020s, well, we're going to start to see a bunch of longevity related solutions that are going to be hitting us and going to actually start to finally be real products or services that we can utilize and will make a difference in our lives. But I had one other thing I thought might be just interesting to bring up.
Yeah, go ahead.
As we look back on this last decade, and that's China. You know, I think I think one thing that many people really did not expect is China to become kind of the global leader in so many different ways. And it's clear to me that, you know, whether it's, it hasn't quite happened yet, but in the decade ahead,
it's happening.
China is. Yeah, but China's won. You know, China is going to be the leader in AI and so many of these technologies. And in a world that is changing so quickly, to be able to have your country kind of change on a dime when one person makes a decision, there's obviously lots of negatives that can go along with that as well. But when it comes to, you know, making investment and advancements in artificial intelligence and autonomous vehicles and energy, I mean, it's just extraordinary how they have really just jumped to the forefront in so many of these different areas.
Yeah, the other one is, that sort of ties in closely with China is AI, right? Because China has made massive investment in artificial intelligence. About 60% of the investment in this decade has been done through China. And so we're actually starting to see them become like a national version of Silicon Valley in some respect, really innovative. Yeah. If you've been to Shenzhen, for example, as a city, probably one of the most innovative cities in the world these days. And you know, if you're listening to this in the US, for example, many people in the US sort of think about China and the early days of the internet sort of copying the stuff that we did in the US. But a great book to read on this is Kai-Fu Lee's Chinese AI Superpowers, rather. And Kai-Fu Lee used to run Google in China, and how he talks about how competitive the market is and how they've started to outstrip the US in some of these core innovation areas like artificial intelligence. It's pretty interesting.
And you combine that with the work ethic, and it's kind of an unstoppable machine. And especially with AI, right, it's one of these things where there can be AI supremacy at some point, and as general AI gets created, you know, the first one to reach that has kind of an ongoing competitive advantage. And it seems like China has gotten that message and realized the power of technology in general to transform their society and to raise up the quality of life for their society. And you know, speaking about the U.S., like, we can't seem to quite get out of our own way. And not investing in the ways that we need to in order to win this thing in the long run.
Yeah, it would help if the Trump administration would actually appoint someone with an AI specialization in the administration. But anyway, that's another point. One of course, the elements of AI has been the emergence of voice. So when did Alexa kick off, John?
Alexa, November 2014. Is when they first delivered them. They actually started a little earlier that year and said, hey, we got something coming out. And it looked like a black Pringles can, and boom, everybody suddenly had Alexas. And I think one of the most powerful things about the Alexa was it shipped right away with a mindset as a platform. When you got it, you could immediately do skills, which was very different than, say, Siri, which I think was a 2011-ish type thing. And it coincided with the death of Mr. Jobs. Sadly, we lost a visionary in this decade as well. But right after that, we got Siri. And then we had this really a mega rise of the voice technology based on the power of AI.
Hey, Siri, what was your creation date?
I don't have an answer for that. Is there something else I can help with?
Hey, Siri, when did you start?
I don't have an answer for that.
I'm not asking the question correctly. How should I ask it?
Siri, when were you born?
Oh, okay. All right, let's try that. Hey, Siri, when were you born?
My first day as an assistant was October 4th, 2011.
There you go. Finally.
Nice.
It's all about how you ask.
It's a little slower than some of those, exactly.
But that does illustrate a little bit of the fact that, you know, even though Siri's been a great tech, it maybe hasn't kept up with the likes of Alexa and Google Assistant in terms of its pure, you know, natural language processing capability. Apple's copped a bit of criticism for that, right?
Well, yeah, I think
that. Yeah, I think that's rightly deserved, I have to say. I have Google Home and Alexa and Siri in my home. And Google Home is by far the most sophisticated, and Siri is kind of embarrassing its inability to do some really basic things still.
Yeah.
But, and I have to say, you know, it's not surprising that it coincided, you know, literally October of 2011 is when Steve Jobs died. And it sort of began a new era of parochialism for Apple. Until that point, they were, hey, we've got this app store and anybody in the world can come in and do this. And I don't know if Steve Jobs would have been around if he would have let them take Siri and turn it into the walled garden that it was, because they would have had to jump on everybody almost 3 years. Because as developers, the first thing we wanted to do, if you remember, Brett, in the finance world was, hey, we want to connect right into Siri and get it to do things. And there was just no way to do it.
Exactly. So I know we're wrapping up. We've just got a few minutes left, guys. But you know, when we look back on this decade in 20 or 30 years' time, what do you think people reflect on were the big changes that were foundational for society?
Well, you know, the Avengers started. Oh, sorry.
The Avengers.
Yep. The Avengers. What can be more important?
I'm just trying to be realistic here.
Yeah, nice. That's right. I mean, I was going to say, I think some of the amazing stuff that's happening with genetics is going to be, the people are going to look back on this decade as really the foundation that allowed us to reimagine what it means to be human and what a human life looks like and what type of things we have to settle for and naturally have to be part of our lives and what we can leave behind. And I really think you're going to see so much of this work start to come into fruition in the decades ahead, I should say.
Absolutely. I have to agree with that. It's going to be, it's going to change the way we think about not only about humanity, but healthcare based on artificial intelligence and gene therapy completely changes because now what you're doing is using that baseline gene therapy to fix the major problems. And then for ongoing healthcare, you're taking your genome, your gut biome, and real-time feedback based on sensors or maybe even ingestibles. To ensure that your health is maintained. So rather than treating a symptom, we'll now be actually treating you based on real-time data about how your body is responding and how your biometric feedback is.
Well, and to piggyback on that, if you add quantum into that, there are medications that we want to make, but we can't get down to the level of math and microbiology that we want to get to. We can't do the computations. We take a computer a million years to figure out some of the things that we want to figure out.
Yeah.
When we have something that can do that, that can take what we're working on, the genome, those sorts of things, combine it with the ability for quantum to be the superposition in quantum, it's going to change all of that. And I think that the genome was the beginning of it. I do agree with that. And then it leads into the rest of this, which is, wow, now we've got this, we've mapped it, we understand it. Now we just need something that we can use to compute it at that level. And when we have that, it's going to be amazing.
Now, with
I'm thinking a cure for cancer, honestly.
We just eliminate it from the genome, yeah. Now, I'm interested, I know we're going to wrap up, but I'm interested that, we didn't talk a lot about robotics.
Well, I mentioned the Roombas.
You mentioned the Roombas.
And robots, and we didn't really talk about data either. I think one big area we really missed is this was the decade of data, right? All of a sudden you had data coming from, hundreds of billions of devices around the world that were previously kind of dumb devices. Now all of a sudden, whether it's autonomous cars that are generating a terabyte of data a day or other things. I mean, it's really this world of connected sensor sharing mass amounts of data and then artificial intelligence and machine learning being able to access that data and leverage it to create all sorts of new insights and analytics around all sorts of different problems. So I think that was one that really jumped out at me as something that this last decade was really was an important part of.
All right. John, have you got any closing comments?
Yeah, I think privacy relates to that. We didn't talk a lot about that. I don't think you can ignore Cambridge Analytica in 2016, and that speaks to the data. And, if I'm looking for some technology that didn't make it that I thought would make it into this decade, again, I feel like we still have another year, it's identity, digital identity, consent, and that speaks to the data that you guys were just mentioning.
Yeah. And Will, your final comments?
I think this has been an extraordinary decade, lots and lots of great progress in so many different areas. I think it was also a decade where we saw some significant red flags raised that the technology is not serving all people well and not moving all lives forward. My hope is that 2020 and beyond is really an extraordinary decade filled with us really being able to leverage the true potential that so many of these technologies offer us and being able to move to a world of renewables and increased power around creativity and the use of AI to help help us create better solutions that really do serve all of humanity. So I'm very optimistic and very excited about the coming decade.
I think all you Singularity guys are all optimists. Techno-optimists.
That's true.
Yeah. All right. So thank you, Will Weissman, Executive Director at Singularity University, Managing Director at Kitty Hawk Ventures. How do we stay in touch with you?
You can reach me at will@kittyhawk.vc or Twitter at wweisman, W-W-E-I-S-M-A-N.
Very good. Thanks for joining us. And John, thanks for joining me as co-host.
Always.
Coming up after
the break, guys.
Pleasure
to talk to you.
Thanks, Will. Coming up after the break, we have Parag Khanna talking about how the economy is going to evolve over the next decade based on the changes we see around global commerce. A really interesting piece. You're listening to Breaking Banks. We will be right back after this break. Let me tell you about one of our new sponsors for Breaking Banks. I love these guys, Bowl and Branch Sheets. And I love them because, you know, I didn't think of flannel sheets as luxury. I didn't think of them as modern. But what these guys have done with these things is they're incredibly comfortable. In fact, they're rated as the softest and most comfortable sheets in the world and the only bedding loved by three U.S. presidents. For a limited time, you can get their luxury flannel bedding to keep you cool, sleepers warm, and because they breathe, keep the warm sleepers cool. Shipping is always free. You can try them out for 30 nights risk-free, and right now, you get $50 off your first set of sheets at bowlandbranch.com with promo code BANKS. You can get $50 off bowlandbranch.com, promo code BANKS. So you spell that B-O-L-L and branch, .com. Don't forget to use the BANKS code to promo code to get you $50 off.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Okay, so I am in Seoul, South Korea, and I ran into Parag Khanna, who is a futurist and an economist and an author. He is the founder and managing director of a company called FutureMap. Parag, welcome to Breaking Banks Radio Show.
Thanks very much. Great to be with you, Brett.
Now, you presented on a really interesting topic today. You explained that there's sort of these three sort of global geographical framing of the economy from the 19th, 20th, and 21st century, ending in sort of this connectedness based on technology. Do you want to give us a quick explanation of
that? Yeah, you know, my view is that, you know, geotechnology, which has now become a popular term, I think I should take more credit for coining it, actually. Geoengineering is the term that refers largely to environmental engineering, but geotechnology as a framework for thinking about power dynamics in the world is something that I began to write about more than a decade ago. And to me, it was sort of the logical successor or complement to geopolitics and geoeconomics. Geoeconomics really rose in the 1980s, 1990s. So to me, though, as I was mentioning in the event that you and I have both been at, is really, it's three equal parts of a triangle. You need geopolitics, you need geoeconomics, you need geotechnology to understand where the world is going, and that the innovation side of things in terms of the geotechnology ultimately drives the economic value and sort of wealth creation on the geoeconomic side. Right. And that is how you ultimately achieve geopolitical power. Import, so these are three interlocking corners of a triangle.
No, I like that concept. It's almost like, you know, the concept of the super apps, like WeChat and so forth.
Gojek and everything.
Yeah, it's almost like economies are becoming these super apps, if you extend that, you know.
Or a country as a super app, or the super appification of a country. And I think, you know, we all know, everyone knows the catalytic impact that WeChat has had on creating efficiencies in the Chinese marketplace and making it cashless, you know, very liquid and you know, high frequency. frequency, high frequency society, you might say, not just high frequency trading, but density of interactions in sociology, right, correlates to the productivity and the dynamism of that society. So China, despite its vast dispersal of people that are, you know, on paper, homogenous from each other, actually becomes a high frequency, high intensity, dense society on the basis of this technology. And, you know, you and I would know what's been happening in Indonesia, you know, the leapfrog that Gojek has achieved. So not surprisingly, they've made Nadiem Makarim, you know, the culture and sports minister of the country.
Because, Gojek's incredible.
Yeah.
So for those of you that don't, for those of you who aren't familiar with Gojek, you know, it's sort of like the Ubers or the Grabs of the world, but this, you can do everything on this. You can order a plumber to come to your house, a masseuse, a tutor for your school kids, someone to do your ironing. Yeah. You know, it's just an incredible sort of layer of services in this super app. So, now you also talked about infrastructure as key. Now, obviously, supply chain automation is part of that, but you showed one visual. I wish I could share it with the crowd, but sort of this global map of infrastructure, energy systems, internet connectivity, you know, transportation, and so forth. So, how is infrastructure and the sort of global connectedness and flow of trade, how's that going to change over the next 50 years in your view?
You know, I wanted people to understand that if we don't map things and don't, we are a visual species, right? Yes. If we don't see it, we don't believe it. So we've taken for granted just how powerful infrastructure is in enabling globalization and allowing, most of all, from an economic standpoint, for investment to be fungible. So the reason that companies are able to move their supply chains out of China today so quickly and move them into Southeast Asia is that you were building the, you know, equivalent caliber of industrial infrastructure and, you know, access to markets through ports and highways and railways and so forth. Again, the supply chain backbone everywhere in the world. Yeah. So it used to be, if this were 50, 40 years ago, you say, well, once I put my money into China, I can't take it out because I built this big heavy duty factory. Well, that stuff is everywhere now. Yeah. So that's infrastructure, right? So it's the physical environment, it's the digital, of course, the digital environment has a physical underpinning. Right. In my connectography book, I talk about the difference between the geopolitics of the internet and the geopolitics in the internet. And the geopolitics of the internet is, of course, servers and cabling and so on. And the geopolitics in the internet is the cyber dimension of you know, IP theft and hacking and so forth. And so again, we've only in the last couple of years begun to appreciate, because of the competitive regulatory dynamics around data privacy protection and so forth, that there is you know, this geopolitics of and geopolitics in the internet. But the point is, there's a physical infrastructural side even to our supposedly wireless connected
smart
world.
Yeah.
But the last thing to answer your question is, of course, it's the rise of the services economy, right? And the digital financial services sectors of the economy are by far the fastest growing everywhere in the world. They're also the fastest growing component of trade, and their total economic value is effectively becoming equivalent to the value of global goods trade. So we have this conversation right now, particularly driven by the Trump administration, where, you know, trade is tantamount to how many physical things are put on containers, on ships, and sailed across an ocean. That's like seriously 19th century view of what trade is, right? Because as you and I know, what we really have in the world is what economists call the Spotify problem, right? Something is made in the cloud anywhere and everywhere, and the geography of sale doesn't correlate and doesn't necessarily even show up in the export statistics of a country, because Spotify UK, you download a song, you pay Spotify UK, but, you know, they obviously have their accounts in Ireland, and it never shows up in Sweden's trade balance, right? Even though it's a Swedish company. That's the real world today. That's so much of where value creation is. And obviously, you know, for you and, you know, in the fintech space, this applies in spades.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why the regulatory framing of things like financial services or healthcare in the past, which has been so geographically bounded, doesn't really make sense in this interconnected world in the same way, does it?
So there's this unbundling of certain sectors, like, you know, it's not the physical delivery of healthcare. Sure, you know, you are where the service is delivered, but it doesn't mean the doctor is, because the doctor could be telemedically linked to you from somewhere else.
Data.
And of course, then the diagnostics, right, where we already see so much of that is now in India, right? And as BPO, the kind of now very simple back you know, back office business process outsourcing that India used to control has gone to the Philippines. But now India is doing radiology and legal and this medical stuff. So there's constant value chain competition because everything is becoming digitized. And I think this is so exciting. And think about the value added in, you know, analyzing radiological records and doing that diagnostic versus, you know, making car parts, right? No question. And yet both are now trade, right? They're both trade.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, one of the things I found interesting in your discussion was, you know, we've got the China Belt and Road Initiative. Obviously, their infrastructure development in Africa has been significant. We've now got them taking ownership of ports because African countries aren't paying back these, you know, these massive loans. Mm-hmm. But you weren't as bullish on China from a sort of a global connectedness perspective.
Yeah, you know, I've actually been saying, using the phrase peak China for a while, and quite frankly, you know, most people are afraid to actually utter those words. You know, you come from Australia originally, and in Australia, China is still, you know, 800-pound gorilla and viewed as a bully. But I tell you from the macro perspective of where kind of the global system is evolving, we are at peak China. We're at peak China in a number of ways. We know that we're demographically at peak China.
Right.
We know their economy is decelerating.
Yep.
And from a geopolitical standpoint, and this is where I think the new turn kicks in, we are at peak China because of the resistance to China. And one of the things I have to explain is the kind of complexity and feedback loop approach to understanding geopolitics. What China does, Belt and Road Initiative, taking over a port, building its military, is only half the story. The other half is the reaction to their action.
Right.
And that's how complexity works.
Right.
That's how feedback loops work. So everything that China does has a reaction that may be equal and opposite. And that's why you see in the diplomatic dynamics, India and Japan and Korea and the United States and Australia forming these counterbalancing alliances. They call it the Quad, right? That wouldn't have existed if China hadn't been rising.
Yeah.
Now you can clearly see with Belt and Road, China is, again, the 800-pound gorilla of infrastructure finance. Now, after China launched Belt and Road, Shinzo Abe flew to Europe and said, we're going to have an EU-Japan sustainable infrastructure finance initiative. The United States and Australia launched something called a Blue Dot Network on certifying bankable infrastructure finance projects. Suddenly, everyone is doing competitive infrastructure finance. Well, you can clearly trace the process. China did something. It's viewed as aggressive. Everyone launches their counter-reaction. So in the end, is the outcome that China dominates the world? No, it's quite the opposite. It's that everyone wakes up and reacts.
Right.
And you wind up restoring a balance, an equilibrium, a multipolarity. So to me, you know, I'm confident in this phrase, peak China, because China is in so many ways sui generis. And the more unique and self-contained and in a way sort of nationalistic a society is, in the same way that Japan was in the 70s and 80s when we feared Japan's rise taking over, you know, the world and so forth, the easier it is to contain them, to know that they are the other, you know.
Right.
And so one of the things I point out is that this idea of, you know, Chinese soft power being so compelling is quite frankly nonsense.
Mm.
More, as many people around the world are utterly suspicious of China as they are of the United States. Right.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Now, what about artificial intelligence, though? Because China has made massive investments comparative to, say, the U.S.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, on AI, I think this is another area where we tend to think in linear terms and shouldn't. So the linear view of AI is, well, whichever country has the most data, puts the most money into AI, has the best software engineers, is going to, you know, capitalize and market and dominate, you know, with their companies, whether it's SenseTime or whatever the case may be. The non-linear view is, well, technology diffusion is the iron law of history. You can't contain any technology within borders. And when you look at, again, from a complexity standpoint, not only is U.S. investment increasing, but Google and major VCs, obviously SoftBank as well, are making big investments in Indian AI companies. So instead of the idea of national AI systems competing in a new digital iron curtain, what you really have is a much more diffuse technological arms race that is both corporate and governmental. And you have AI as a service competing with each other. So why would country X that's concerned about, say, Baidu or whomever, you know, taking over its national data systems, why would they have to go with the US or China at all when there's some company in Bangalore that's going to do it for half the price of the Indians, of the Chinese or the Americans without any threat to your data? Right. So we're basically almost at that point already. So again, the linear view is wrong. Technology diffusion is more powerful than either America or China.
Yeah.
And everything is getting cheaper, obviously, as well. So where the brains move and where where the money moves and who hustles the most in these markets to do things faster, better, and cheaper. That's the correct answer to where this is going. But if you begin with the wrong assumption, which is that there's an American system and a Chinese system and you have two choices and you must pick one as to who will lead the world, you're going to come out with the wrong answer.
Right.
Right? Wrong question, wrong answer. Yeah. Right.
Because neither are perfect systems. So last question before we wrap up. If you were an entrepreneur or you were looking to establish business, where would you be living right now to build a business over the next 20 years?
It depends really on, you know, what the business is. But obviously, if we're talking about, you know, digital technology, you know, I think, you know, there's talent is clearly diffusing. You know, I have my own brother and a lot of friends who run tech companies in Silicon Valley don't even have engineers living anywhere near them anymore. They're everywhere, right? So they've gone into the cloud. You know, so I guess the cheeky answer to the question is build it in the cloud. Yeah, yeah. You know, there's no question. You know, I happen to live in Singapore, but I don't really run a technology company. My wife runs an AI company, and she's got 70 data scientists. Guess where they are? They're in Lahore, Pakistan.
Yeah.
But almost all of them have Western degrees in data science, machine learning, AI, and so forth. So wherever you decide to assemble the brains, you know, whether it's part in the cloud, part physical, you know, different places, that's what you do. The question at the end of the day, as we all know, is are you in the right markets? Not even so much where are you building the product, it's where are you selling the product ultimately. Yeah. That's going to be the decisive factor in whether you get ahead of the competition or not.
But you are bullish on Asia generally, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the book is called The Future is Asian, so it kind of says it on the cover. I'm bullish on Asia, and not because there aren't, you know, dark spots or clouds or downside scenarios. There are many, and I discuss all of them. But there's also the fact that over a period of a couple of decades, you know, every region of the world has the stars align at some moment in time. Yeah. It could be early 20th century America. It could be post-war Europe.
Right.
There's no reason why it shouldn't be the case that according to demographics and infrastructure investment and geopolitical stability, that Asia wouldn't be having the moment that it's
exactly
having right now.
Yeah.
And it is.
Young population,
absolutely,
growing economies.
So one would be in, you know, serious, you know, sort of denial of logic to pretend that it's not happening. And then again, what I often find, though, it's not so much a denial, it's that our psychology lags behind reality.
Yeah.
We already today, right now, live in a world where Asia is more than half the world population.
Exactly.
We already live in a world where, in PPP terms, Asia is more than half of global GDP. That's today. So I'm not so sure why I would have to bother convincing anyone of what is already the case and that is not in dispute. But I think the question really that I'm asking is, can Asians govern Asia well? They'll certainly do better than colonialism did. The question is, will they undo some of the unfortunate divisions? Will they overcome the cultural tensions and geopolitical tensions that are the legacies of the Cold War? And can they have, you know, the kind of stability that they want, but also be open, you know, culturally open, intellectually open, politically open societies? Those are open questions. I know for sure, and you and I know, they are not looking to, the UK of Brexit and the America of Trump for answers,
no,
right?
Exactly
so the place
not.
To be is Asia, if for no other reason to witness a story that doesn't have a right or wrong answer, and we don't know the answer. And that makes it incredibly exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. So where can people find out more about your book and your musings on the subjects?
Everything's at paragkhanna.com. You know, the books, the articles,
and your Twitter handle is the same,
at paragkhanna. Yep, I got in early.
All right, we'll make sure we tweet that out for the show as well. But thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King, Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.